You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the 20th to the 26th of March 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and Holly Else and Deputy News Editor John Morgan. Will the economic costs of the government's tuition fee reforms soon exceed those of the system it replaced? That's the scenario depicted in a new report that we'll discuss in a second. Should RCUK funding be tied to universities' diversity accreditation through initiatives such as Athena Swan? Holly will have more on that in a second. And are universities beset by a racist mindset that views black people as outsiders? And can that explain why just 85 of the UK's 18,500 professors are black? Finally, we will hear from reporter David Matthews, who's not here, but I spoke to him earlier about his cover feature on pre-degree pathway courses targeted at overseas students. But first, John, fees are up, we know that, but a new report suggests it's all to no avail. The new system's going to wind up just as expensive to the government as the old one was.
Yes, so these are the suggestions that the government won't have saved any money by trebling fees to £9,000 and scrapping virtually all direct grants to universities. So London Economics, a consultancy, has published a report calculating the exact point at which the rising estimates of subsidies for student loans will make the £9,000 system more expensive than more expensive to the public purse than the old system. Mm. And this relates to the resource accounting and budgeting charge, the RAB charge.
The famous RAB charge.
Which is the estimate on the portion of loans that will never be repaid by graduates because of all the write-offs and subsidies for the loans. And London Economics, who actually carried out some of the research on the higher education white paper for BIS, so they're definitely not idiots. They've calculated that if the RAB charge gets to 48.6%, that's the point at which the new system becomes more expensive than the old. And that point may not be very far off at all, because David Willetts, the university's minister, told MPs on the BIS committee in January that the RAB estimate would be revised upwards from its current 40%. There have been a series of revisions already that have taken up from the original 28%.
So significantly.
It sounds like it is going to get very close to that point at which supposedly you tip into the territory where you may as well not have bothered introducing the fees, and you would have done without all the upheaval and the riots as well.
So what's the solution? I mean, is that higher still fees, a complete rethink? Do we need a white paper that actually goes somewhere to solve this?
I think that would if we do reach that point, it will further increase the debate around alternative models. Would a graduate tax be a better long-term solution? I'm sure Million Plus and NUS would be keen to try and persuade any Labour government of that being the right course. But you're right, there could be arguments to just tinker with the current system. You could increase, or you could decrease the point at which graduates start repaying their loans from the current £21,000, which some people think is quite generous, and maybe make it kick in at £15,000, and that might make the loan system look significantly healthier.
Indeed, not too healthy at the moment, though. Holly, you've got an article this week on Research Councils UK. Looks at how they might think about tying funding to universities, to their diversity. What's the story?
Well, this isn't something that would happen overnight. Basically, the situation is that the RCUK sent out to universities a statement of expectations on gender and diversity in 2013. And they're now at the stage of thinking about collecting evidence from universities in response to this statement, and then thinking sort of what will happen next if perhaps this evidence is not showing that universities are getting themselves up to scratch in that area. And I spoke to Dr. Ian Cameron. He's the head of Research, Careers and Diversities at RCUK. And he said sort of, this isn't going to happen overnight, but perhaps if there is no evidence, RCUK should be intervening a bit more firmly, and that could be requiring universities to have something like Athena Swan or other initiatives before they're eligible for Research Council funding.
Quite a shake-up for a lot of institutions, because it's a persistent issue in HE, isn't it, this frequent lack of diversity?
Yeah, it is. I mean, other funders have already taken this step. So the Department of Health Research funding from 2015 is only available to medical schools that have the Silver Athena Swan Award. So, I mean, it has been talked about in other circles, but, you know, one of the issues Dr. Cameron mentioned was that the research councils don't fund all research, so it's quite difficult for them to regulate the entire system that way. And I mean, we had a bit of a mixed verdict from academics who we spoke to about this. One Professor Louise Morley from the University of Sussex said this move is pretty overdue, whereas Janet Hemingway, who is the director of the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine, she said she doubted that it could make a huge impact on the ground in terms of what universities were doing.
Indeed.
I think part of the issue here is that Athena Swan is a bit vague, really. When they award an Athena Swan Silver or Bronze Award, they don't put out a public report saying, this is why you got it. So it's a bit of a sort of black box, in a way, and I don't think you can have millions of pounds riding on something where it's still a little bit opaque about what you have to do. I mean, obviously, there's certain criteria, but it's not all that obvious from the outside what you need to get.
We've certainly carried stories as well in the past where institutions that have received Athena Swan Awards have had members of staff reporting that practices perhaps weren't quite as up to scratch as they should have been.
I mean, has anyone ever lost an Athena Swan Award?
I think they have. In fact,
well, it's hard to know because they don't publish that information.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work to still be done really before this can become viable. I think that's what Professor Hemingway was getting at when she said, you know, that you might well have the award, but how we're working on the ground could be a different matter.
Jack, anyway, keeping the diversity theme going, you attended a talk at UCL entitled "Why Isn't My Professor Black?" What was discussed there, and what's the story about this week?
This was a very interesting event at UCL, chaired by their provost and president, Michael Arthur, and it looked at the issue of why there aren't more black academics and more senior black academics. It was said that there are only 85 of the UK's 18,500 professors are black, and only 17 of these are black women.
That's an incredible statistic.
It is quite amazing, and you could try and explain it via the sort of demographics and the fact that maybe sort of people of professorial age, there aren't as many sort of black people in the country, and sort of work at it from that angle. Or you could, as lots of these very interesting black academics speaking at this conference were saying, that there is a sort of racist mindset within many universities, and that black people are viewed as outsiders or interlopers working within the academy. And there was some really interesting testimony from these people saying how, you know, they did feel like they were marginalised, and they didn't really feel comfortable. They lacked mentors and networks. They found access to these routes to academic progression were denied to them. So it was a very interesting talk.
Yeah, and a very interesting write-up on page 11 as well. Carrying on from that, this week we have an opinion piece from Nathaniel Adam Tobias Coleman, who's Britain's first research associate in the philosophy of race at UCL. He spoke at that event we were just discussing. Interestingly, he spells Coleman in his surname with a line through it, as if it's been crossed out. Jack, I think there's a story behind that as well.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting one. It's because he has a sort of rather ambivalent about his own name. The first three names, Nathaniel, Adam, Tobias, were given to him by his parents. He's quite happy with those. But Coleman comes from his family background in Jamaica. Both his parents were from Jamaica, and he was descended from slaves. And this name Coleman was given to his family. And he feels, as a philosophy professor, at philosophy lecturer, he wants to sort of raise this issue of his final name that was given to him by people who basically wanted to own him. And he wants to sort of point out this stigma of Coleman that he has to sort of carry around with him, that his name was sort of given to his family without their choosing. I think it's quite an interesting idea that he highlights, and he's written a very powerful piece in the magazine this week about it. Absolutely. And various other issues relating to the work of black academics in UK universities.
Absolutely interesting stuff. That's all from this week's issue review, except one final bit. I spoke earlier to David Matthews, a reporter who's not with us at the minute, about his feature on the for-profit pre-degree pathway centres that have sprung up across the UK. Here's what he had to say. So, David, most people probably know what we mean by pre-degree pathway centres, but for those who don't, what are they?
So the centres run courses, usually for international students, and they're usually about a year long. Fees are comparable with a year of a degree, and they essentially teach you to kind of an A-level standard in either, you know, business or science and engineering or social science, that kind of thing. And you learn for a year, you're taught for a year, and then you take exams at the end. And quite often the deal is that if you get a certain mark in these exams, if you pass with 70% or so, you get a guaranteed offer to study at the linked university, basically. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can see why they're a pretty good deal for international students. You know, they get an extra year in the UK to improve their English, and often they get, you know, a guaranteed offer from a UK university, and then they can sort of stay there and complete their degree.
Yeah, so the biggest private for-profit companies offering these courses are Study Group, Kaplan International Colleges, Into University Partnerships, Navitas, and the Cambridge Education Group. I guess one question is, I mean, you say they get a place at the university they're affiliated with, so say UEA has an Into partnership. Does this not raise questions a bit about academic standards and...
Well, I guess that's one of the questions that has been raised over this, you know, over these kind of partnerships. I mean, I think when we talk to people or to universities that host these centres, some do seem to have targets for how many students get through, and others don't seem to have targets. So one year, the student just could be much lower quality and they make far fewer offers. And the question is whether, because the companies are often owned by private equity or listed on a stock market, they've got, you know, as you would expect, you know, tough revenue profit targets. You know, the question is whether they would put, you know, recruitment of students and getting them through this process above the, you know, above the academic standards needed to get into the university. Mm. On the other hand, I mean, as people point out, you know, it's pretty obvious someone who's already spent a year in the UK in you know, immersed in English and then goes on to the university afterwards is probably, you know, going to be an advantage, and rather than coming from a different country straight into the university, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So how do the financial figures tend to stack up? So if I've got an Into centre at a university, and then a student comes and pays, you're saying, sort of almost equivalent figures to a year of university study, what's the sort of breakup? What does the university get, and what do I get as one of those for-profit operators?
Well, I think the for-profit operators get the fees because they're doing the teaching. What you get as a university is a pretty good guaranteed stream of international students. Because if you say a standard international student applying from China, for example, may well apply to several universities, you give them an offer, you've got no idea whether they'll actually take it or not. If they're already on your campus and they've got this guaranteed offer from you, you're going to be pretty sure that they can take it. So it offers that certainty. And what the providers say as well, the private providers, is that, you know, they can recruit students from across the world, and they've got this recruitment network that's basically, you know, much larger than anything an individual university could offer. So they, you know, if a university wants to diversify away from a particular country, say they've got, you know, they've recruited loads of Indian students, for example, and they're a bit nervous about whether the demand will continue, they can go to these companies and say, right, well, we want, you know, a far bigger range of students. And that, and I suppose that can help on campus as well. I mean, there's concerns that you get some courses dominated by just one, nationality of international student, and you know, so you don't get a kind of global, I suppose, melting pot in the lecture room as you might like. And it's fascinating. I mean, we've reported a lot in the past on, you know, universities like BPP University, the College of University of Law, rather, and these are for-profit universities, and that's obviously a big change in the sector, and it's worried some people. But I think what this feature does is looks at the kind of the other end, the sort of nibbling away at the other end of university provision by, you know, equally for-profit companies, but who have actually been welcomed in by universities to kind of solve a problem, as it were.
Risen rather more stealthily, perhaps, less checked.
Yeah, they've definitely had a lot less scrutiny on them, and there doesn't seem to be a great deal of good up-to-date data, although we do try and provide a latest figure which shows around, you know, more than 15,000 pathway students are currently being taught by these companies in the UK at the moment. And one of the interesting things, I mean, it's, you know, this is interesting in itself, but what's just as interesting is the provider's future plans. So you speak to them, especially a guy called James Pittman from Study Group, and he really sees a sort of, his was a sort of golden age of private public partnership on this. And he says, well, actually, why do universities need to teach or use their academics to teach first year students when in fact you're going to be going over the same stuff, and you know, you want to concentrate those academics when students are in their second and third years and doing dissertations and so on? Why not hand over that first year to an outside company like Study Group? Obviously, that would be massively controversial, and you can see a huge number of people would object to that, I'm sure. But for some international students, that is already happening. These private providers are not just teaching you the year before you enter university for some international students. They're actually teaching the first year for international students, and then you enter directly into the second year in some universities. So it, and you know, they're also providing universities with capital for buildings. So there's a shortage of money to go around at the moment. Universities want to tap into that money from the private sector, but can they do so without sort of riding a tiger, as it were?
So some for-profit attrition at the early years of a university education. More on that in this week's cover feature. But that's all for this week's issue review. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, you'll find us in all the usual places at timeshighereducation.co.uk, on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+. If there's anything you want to say, please do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.